if we turn to the Finance Committee agenda, are there any additions, changes, corrections to the Finance Committee agenda? If not, it's approved as presented. The minutes, any adjustments to the minutes, additions, corrections? If not, they are approved as presented. Our first and only action item is on the 2009 financial audit. Ms. Lou? Helen? Okay, there she is. You're getting the auditors to come down? Do you want us to move to other items while we... Yes, okay. Let's start with the first information item. Is Mr. Bonnier, Dennis Bonnier, here? Yes. We're moving to information item 4A.
Thank you very much. So this is a high-level presentation intended to kick off and really provide a foundation for a conversation with the jurisdictions over the coming months, and takes the opportunity to kick it off by highlighting major priorities that staff have identified through an in-depth prioritization process. And our work with the jurisdictions over the next few months will flesh out details of a next funding agreement using the work we've done to date as a starting point. And today's presentation is one of the first steps we're taking to gather feedback regarding details surrounding the funding agreement. JCC, or a working group of the jurisdictions, is going to be having their second meeting this afternoon to sharpen the pencil on these points. This presentation is, in addition to being part of a kickoff of a conversation with all of you and with the region, this presentation is also intended to convey an idea of how much effort has gone into the prioritization process today and what it really means for Metro.
Next slide.
This slide is just a reprise of what you've seen before. It's a recapitulation of the capital needs that we have identified for the agency over the 2011 to 2020 period. Approximately two-thirds of that falling into the performance and safety category, about a third of it focusing on customer demand and also safety. And slide three is a reminder of the context for the inventorying of our capital needs, why they're the magnitude that they are. The system is, you've heard many times, it's over 30 years old now. The original assets, both vehicles and infrastructure, need repair and replacement. Continuing ridership growth leads to system growth needs, and we've underinvested in things like IT. We need to catch up on the state of the art. And just a note again that this inventory does not include system extensions, new stations or station entrances, or other jurisdictional asset investments, access investments, such as parking, and it also does not include debt repayment costs. Next slide is, to some extent, this slide is a motherhood, an apple pie, business school, or policy school process for how to do sensible strategic capital planning and programming, and so I don't really want to belabor this too much, but I do want to point out that establishing a more systematic process, planning and programming that links projects to strategic goals and business goals has been a recommendation of a number of external reviews of Metro's capital programs over the recent years, including the Government Accountability Office. This slide really, I guess, is intended to convey three points. One is that we are responding to external calls for a more strategic and business case process. Second, I wanted to highlight that we have completed the first two steps at this point. We have completed the capital needs inventory. We have completed the capital prioritization. CFO's office is in the process of preparing a draft capital budget for the coming year and laying out 10-year spending program on a project-by-project basis that the jurisdictional staff and you all can begin to review as well. The other point is that this is a circle and that we intend to repeat this regularly on a yearly or bi-yearly basis from now going forward. And it's an open circle as well that incorporates the input of the JCC, the RAC, public. I'm sure it'll be coming up in our public meetings this fall, and of course yourselves. For this slide, I guess I wanted to, the takeaway I guess I wanted you all to get from this was the energy and the structure that was put into the prioritization exercise. These photographs were taken during a period of 5 days. Obviously, there was a lot of work that went up to it and succeeded it. But basically, I had a team of 15 people representing all of Metro's departments sitting to score each of the rate and rank, each of the roughly 140-odd capital projects that we had in the program. And each one of them had a clicker in their hand. It's like a reality show, night of the capital project stars. And and each project was basically assessed according to 5 strategic goals, and for each of those strategic goals, a couple of sub-objectives that had been identified through working with the JCC and the RAC and our own sort of need to have something specific that a project could be scored on. And so basically, you've got 15 people and 140 projects and 12 items for each one that needs to be scored, and you've got for each one of these projects a project manager who has to basically make a pitch in a room like this and say, this is my project, this is what it is, this is what it does for the agency, and people then score it. It was very intense, and one of the things that beyond, I think, really setting a new standard for making business decisions linked to strategic goals for the agency, it's also really helping to strengthen a culture of making business case arguments. Gerald Francis, I know months ago, had talked to me about someone he talked to who was, truing rail car wheels, and his point was, I want that person not to just say, I need a new machine, but this person needs to have in his mind or her mind what I need the machine for. And, it's for safety, it's for quality of service, it's for saving us money. And this process of having people in the room together is one of the first steps. And I think that's very important. It may not be an easily measurable item, but I know that some of the feedback we've gotten from participants in the process was that there's been much better communication between people in different departments and much better establishment of linkages between different capital projects, which previously we might not have seen as being related to one another. This slide just sort of tries to convey an idea of the certain kinds of projects the objectives that we use to score projects under each one of the major goals. The 5 major goals, I think we've talked about them before: creating a safety culture, providing quality service, using every resource wisely, training the best and the brightest, and maintaining and enhancing our image in the region. And these were some of the specific objectives that we tried to have scored for each project. Next slide. Again, this is just sort of an illustration of what happened. Certain projects were more tightly aligned with certain goals. You can see police radio replacement being aligned with safety culture, bus replacement with quality service, going down to website updates and customer communication with an enhancement of our image. So there are projects that particularly align. And I guess that's sort of the next slide. I'm going to talk a little bit about after all of these projects had been rated. We had a firm supporting this that has a linear programming algorithm, and what it's basically trying to do is looking at the cost of all the projects, looking at the ratings that have been established for them. It tries to take a certain amount of money and buy the most amount of benefit for the agency.
Mr. Bellinghauer, may I stop you for a moment because we do have some questions?
Yes.
One question I have is you have specific projects that you're talking about, the linkages, but they're not mutually exclusive to those categories. For instance, rehabilitation not only is a safety issue, but also deals with quality of service, image. So, there are some things that...
Absolutely.
And the reason I'm bringing this up is later on you talk about if we just fund all the safety-type projects at a certain level of funding for the organization, we won't be able to get to some of the performance ones yet. Some of these projects in the safety area do impact on the other elements. So I just wanted to clarify that for you right now.
Your point is exactly right. And really, to be a highly rated project, you really would need to have a high rating across all of those. And absolutely, those points were reflected in the rating.
Mr. Lindman.
on the point on what you just, something you just stated. I'm curious about the, you know, we often, we have a capital is so hard to come by, and we have so many capital needs, and I know this is kind of listing of projects from all our staff members and our team has been probably an exhaustive experience. One of the concerns I have is what kind of opportunity do we have to look at a life cycle costing as we redo projects and make decisions that purchasing items that may be a little more costlier in its actual price, but in long-term operating costs and maintenance costs are considered as a factor, and we can get best value versus low cost initially. Because I know you could squeeze your capital program and try to get the most out of it because of the availability of dollars today, and that could be a guiding principle. Or you could look at one of our challenges from year to year is operating costs. How do we maintain OM throughout the course of each individual year? And then you can make some determination that, you know, item X may cost me $10 more in the initial year of purchase, but the life cycle cost at OM would factor that in to be a much better deal to go with item X that costs $20 more. So I'm trying to figure out, how do we calculate that as we go through?
So it's a very important issue that we want to reflect in the scoring of projects in the future. I guess I would say at this point, we, being sort of the first time out of the gate asking all the project managers questions, I think we were asking these questions and not necessarily having that level of information right now. I think what we're establishing is an expectation is that the next time we go through this, there needs to be a much stronger quantitative assessment of exactly that point. Is there another alternative that is better for saving operating costs or, in the future? I want to make that link.
And second part of that is what kind of opportunity we have procurement-wise to look at items that way in terms of best value versus lowest cost?
Well, we do that currently based upon however the parameters are set within a procurement. It can be either low cost, it can be best value, or it can be some other evaluating guidelines. So we actually have the ability to do that now, and we do that at times, based upon whatever the evaluation method, whatever is appropriate. So we do that in some instances.
So the software and the consultant support that we used to take all of this information that we gathered was used to, you look at all the projects and you say, well, some projects, you have to do the entire capital project cost. It's not divisible into sub-piece components. Some, like bus acquisition, it is divisible. Some projects, if I do X, I don't do Y, and there are other projects where you say, if I do X, I must do Y. There are linkages between capital projects and the program. And some of you just sort of hardwire, you say, this is an NTSB recommendation, no matter what happens, this is something that we have to do. If you sort of tag all the projects in the program, along with the ratings, run this, this calculator that tries to, in aggregate, generate the most benefits to the agency given a dollar constraint. And so the next slide basically shows the results of three different funding constraints that we put out there and our characterization of, in aggregate, what the result of that is. And obviously, if there were no funding constraints whatsoever on our needs, all of the performance and safety projects and all of the customer safety and demand projects that we had identified in the inventory would have been funded. The historical funding scenario of the last couple of years is characterized on the far right, and what that depicts is that we didn't have sufficient money to pay for expansion or for a number of the customer amenities that we've identified in the inventory, and we would have funded about 70% of what we believe our system needs. Some critical technology wouldn't be updated. 40% of our rail rehab needs wouldn't be funded. Some needed bus rehabilitation would be deferred. So the middle scenario is looking at basically the funding scenario that was Blue Ribbon, Metro Blue Ribbon panel recommendation, and based on our submission to the TIP in the, for the last 6 years, and the presentation that was made to you last fall about a reasonable expectation of long-term funding. And this shows that there is, in our, you know, in our view, the opportunity to provide steady asset management to support expansion, to get us to 100% eight-car trains by 2020, to support a modest expansion of bus service and priority corridor network in the region, and maintaining a safe and reliable system. So again, it's a high-level view of what we're able to afford with different funding levels. Next slide, please. Again, this goes into some detail on the, you know, an $8 billion funding constraint. The kinds of things that are funded are the 1,000 series, 2,000, 3,000 series replacement, 4,000 series rehab. You can beat all the things that are here. Some things that would be deferred, a number of customer demand needs, some core station capacity. We'd be rehabbing our newest assets. There are certain segments that we would be prioritizing based on the fact that they're over 30 years old. There's some parts of the system that have been more recently built. Obviously, we would not be rehabbing them during this 10-year period. Next. And then we have just sort of a series of recommendations coming out of the review of capital projects, when obviously we clearly need to make safety a top priority. Safety and quality service were the two highest ranked strategic objectives for us in the project scoring process. Together, they were almost 70% of the total weighted weighting for the way we looked at the projects. And obviously, we're going to need to include the NTSB and fund NTSB recommendations and other safety projects. Next slide. Number of performance and safety projects we think that should be, we would hope as we work with the jurisdictional representatives, that we'd be replacing and rehabilitating buses and rail cars based on our life cycle, rehabilitating sections of the system that are more than 30 years old, fully funding track infrastructure needs, fully funding Metro Transit police capital needs, upgrading IT to get us to closer to the state of the art, and also replacing and rehabilitating three bus garages. It's a very important part of creating effective working conditions and efficient vehicle maintenance. Next.
Did you identify the three bus garages?
We have not identified specifically. We are, we'll be talking about that in more detail in December when we come forward with the plan. In the area of customer demand and safety, we think it's, you know, it's an expectation of our rail capacity forecast that we will need all eight car trains by 2020. It's a, our recommendation that we are providing funds for this expansion and all the associated support needs for that, including traction, power, and storage. We want to make sure that we can support bus fleet expansion to meet growing demand and to reflect that mode's importance to the region, shown during the summer and as we forecasted. We want to make sure that we enhance safety and security through police training facilities and cameras, safety domes. We want to make sure that we're dedicating funding to plan and design future core capacity enhancements that we know we'll need in the 2020 and beyond period. We're confident that we can deliver projects at an increased level. One is that just for a large share of the program dollars is highlighted for, it's dedicated to vehicle acquisition. Those are steady, ongoing projects. They're not subject to sort of, you know, obviously, to getting track rights and things. We are putting in place a new streamlined procurement process for rehabilitation of line segments. Improved a number of items in the last month and year for red line rehabilitation, for example. And we're working very hard on putting in place advanced procurement actions that streamline the procurement process. Next slide. So going forward, one of the things that we wanted to just put out there, and we've discussed these with JCC, these are some initial thoughts, but really these are areas that the jurisdictional working group that we're working with will be giving back to us as principles that we think should be in people's minds as we're putting together another funding agreement. It's just having a predictable level of funding so that we're in a position to be able to forecast and program over a multi-year period. Again, replacement of assets on the basis of life cycles. You know, I think it's a fairly reasonable commitment to match federal funds with local, and I think for you, you're going to want to see an increased level of accountability and flexibility from us in a programming process that matches the kinds of processes you have in your own jurisdiction. Referred to a number of these so far in the presentation, so I'll go through them quickly, but we're anticipating that we would come up with a multi-year program that would it'd be a rolling capital program. It would be updated annually. We would put out established guidelines for reprioritization on an annual basis that continuing to link our project prioritization to goals of the type that Director Linton referenced and our overall strategic goals and policies. The first year of any multi-year program would effectively be the capital budget for the following fiscal year and a basis for contract approval. And that there will be significant jurisdictional review and comment. Again, an anticipated kind of annual schedule would be for us to come out with a draft multi-year program in the August-September timeframe. There'd be a couple of months for feedback from the jurisdictions and giving more specifics to that before it was finalized and locked down for the following 6 year or 8 year, whatever the period, the funding period would be. Next steps for us is from the October-March time period, we're working together with a jurisdictional working group. They are feeding back to us and we are feeding to them our thoughts on guiding principles, which is the ones we've talked about, funding arrangement. And we're anticipating in the next couple of weeks a publication of a much more comprehensive planning document that details the 2011 to 2020 capital needs. It links it to a long-term vision for metro growth and expansion, and all of the project details will be available on the web. And we're going to come to you in December with an FY 2011 budget, and we're looking to June 30th of 2010 as a deadline for us having a next funding agreement. Fine. That concludes the presentation. Available to answer questions.
Let me just comment that, first of all, that this is an information item, that we're not approving or disapproving anything here. We're just trying to learn some more, and I also want to compliment staff on the fact that this is a very thoughtful and very thorough presentation. And I particularly like the idea that we have defined here not a product but a process, and a process that can be a continuing process, and in particular the idea that on an annual basis we will have a multi-year program that moves forward by a year, and the first year element that we would have presented to us presumably in December and have the entire spring to work on and then approve in June. I think that's what you were proposing here, right, as a process.
I want to, I guess, leave the details of exactly what that is to the jurisdictional working group, but I mean, that's...
And that's the other part, is I think by involving the jurisdictions in that process of defining all of this and defining those priorities and reviewing those projects, I think we have a process that could work quite well should we move forward with that. Mr. Zimmerman.
A couple of questions. First, if you go to the slide that we have, it's page 38. I don't know what slide that is. It's the impact of $8 billion funding constraints.
The three pie chart slide?
There's two pie charts, actually.
Okay, I'm sorry. Right, okay.
I guess it's the one after the three pie charts.
Yep.
The last thing, I mean, so I understand, when you say $1 billion funding constraint, you mean you get to fund 8 and not 11?
This, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
What do you mean by $8 billion funding constraint?
That if we had $8 billion to work with over a 10-year period.
And not 11.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay. So, and the reason for picking that arbitrary number?
It was sort of the basis of the Blue Ribbon Panel's assessment of long-term needs. It's our assessment of needs. It's existing Metro Matters funding levels plus $150 million a year federal and $150 million local.
Okay, I understand all, Mr. Cato.
Based upon existing funding or sources that we've been able to project, it does not anticipate major increase in federal funding. If that occurs, then it moves closer to the 11.
The point is, you got to 8 by thinking you're going to have 8.
Yes.
And you're basing that on both the bill in Congress, assuming it is funded as it is in both appropriations bills, not yet passed, sent out to the President, but in both sides of Congress, and that the states match that as they have said they would, and that they do it every year for the next 10 years.
Yes.
That. And that gets you $3 billion. And you got another $5 billion based on, that's kind of the rate at which you've been getting capital funding from us under Metro Matters.
Yes, yes.
But you would still have to get, you don't actually have that in hand either, because Metro Matters is over, and we have to figure out if the localities and states are going to kick in, even to get you to 8.
Yes.
And then you would be short $3 billion.
That's a correct statement.
Okay. Now, just to pick one of these that jumped out at me, at the bottom of that next slide, we go to the next one. Among the things that don't happen if we don't come up with $11 billion, if we're at 8, is that 30% of the bus fleet expansion needs are deferred. Now, if I asked you today what our average fleet age is on our bus, who would know the answer?
As we guess, I think it was 6 years for me. I was told it's 7.5, but it doesn't include the calculation of the newer buses. That's the goal.
I was wondering what we actually are. Okay, so let me give you the rest of the questions, and you can get the answer when you got it. So just so you know what the next questions are going to be. The question to be, what's the average age? How does that compare to nationally? I mean, what do we look like compared to other systems, particularly the good ones? And then, if you did this, what does that do to average fleet age over the period of 10 years? I don't necessarily need that answer today. As the chairman pointed out, we're not acting anything on today. But I think that's the kind of information that people, not just on this committee, but those who are going to make the decisions on whether we have $8 billion or $11 billion or any billion, need to understand. What are the implications for those for what people will actually see? Because, and you know, you can go on. This is expansion. It says expansion. But, of course, expansion, that just means meeting demand.
That's right.
Because if you don't do expansion, you're saying the fleet will be the same size it is today, and every year there's more people here wanting to get around. So, you know, just as we're pushing for 8-car trains on the grounds that they're filling up, more people are coming. But almost all the time when there are funding constraints on capital, well, when there are funding constraints on operations, that happens too, it's the bus system that goes.
Yes.
So, you know, when we don't have money to make budget, what are we talking about? We're talking about cutting bus routes. When we don't have money on capital, what are we talking about? We're talking about not replacing buses. We're not adding to buses to meet growing demand. That's not new service. That's not like putting a new train line in. That's equivalent to simply adding cars on a line to carry more people. Same thing we're talking about here, basically. So I think that we need to have, and I picked that one example, but I'm sure there are others. If you go through the table that was appended at the end, and you see the numbers in that column that say percent funded $8 billion, and you pick out the ones that are less than 100%, you know, for those kind of things, there are going to be implications. We need that translated in terms of people can understand what it means you will see or not see if we don't fund the $11 billion. And while we're at it, we better figure out what it means if you don't fund the $8 billion, because the $8 billion isn't something we have in hand either. Thank you.
Mr. Linton?
I was just curious how much of our assessment has looked at our maintaining of projects in good repair, and how are we lining up with these, even your $8 billion target? What portion of that would you think is focusing on maintaining good repair, since that seems to be a major theme with federal support for capital at this point? I'm just trying to see how we make up with that.
Actually, the majority of the $8 billion, that is the state of good repair. That's how we've defined it. In fact, in our discussions with the Federal Transit Administration, because we participated in their study, anticipated that figure just to keep our system in a good operating, reliable state of repair.
Where would that put us if we got something imposed upon us about our safety rail? Where have we put any guesstimate? And I know all of the engineering firms are still trying to figure out what, in fact, that would cost, and we haven't gotten any guesstimates of bills yet. But is anything even covered that would consider a major rail rehabilitation or something with circuits or anything of that nature?
Well,
would that be above the line, or would that be included in the safety?
That is included in the eighth item. And the maintenance of the repair of the system and doing this is a full system rehab for the older segments is definitely part of the of this, and we're focusing on basic performance first. I mean, that gets back out the first dollars. But your question is, what would be the cost of a total system overhaul?
I'm just trying to find out, you know, we're still waiting to find out from the engineering firm what a redundant system would look like, or what the circuit would be, since there is none at this point. But we could get imposed at some point in the course of this funding cycle for something like that. If that was imposed, would that be above the $8 billion?
And really, it will be above, depending upon what's imposed. And, you know, that's where we're not, we don't know yet.
No, crystal ball.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure, conceptually, we're recognizing that, as Chris indicated, even with the $8 billion, there's needs that we are still leaving on the table. And as he suggested, many of that will fall forward from the buses. But then, and on top of that, we may get some edict from somewhere that says, you need to do this and cut something else out.
Cell phone availability.
Yeah, I mean, so they could impose something else within that restricted fund and say, this has to be done.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. I mean, there are a number of details at this point that we obviously can't include in this. This is a high-level aggregate presentation. The intent of establishing the process that we're talking about is to be able to react to that on an annual basis and to reprogram as necessary when we have new priorities that need to come up. So
sure.
That's the intent.
And this discussion, not being circle, is more framing for everybody our constraints and what we have to work with as we move forward. That's why this discussion, I think, is important for us to have openly and for all of us to think about it.
Ms. Hutchins.
I appreciate the presentation, and I think it's a very good presentation, but I think we need another slide in here, and that we are talking to the funders, but we also need to be talking to the customers, and what does this mean to them? And I need that discussion in order for those folks to communicate with the elected officials that are going to be very much part of this. I think we're talking at the level of the infrastructure improvement, but we have to talk about the delivery of service. For the folks that stood on the platform with me this morning, I think they want to know, What are we going to do to change the system to the level of efficiency that we believe it should be, and how do we maintain that? And that's what this speaks to, but I don't think we articulated in that.
Understood.
I think that's extremely important.
Mr. Graham?
Thank you. I think I just would agree with what's been said, particularly as it relates to this massive wild card on page 39, NTSB recommendations. You know, I mean, when you think about this and how this impacts, you spent 5 days on this process. Is that the senior
that staff group meeting on that? Yeah.
5 days you spent on this process.
No.
Because I think that all of that work is well intentioned as it is. You know, we just don't know how to respond to this. First, we don't know what the recommendations are. But if they're anything like the recommendations that we had on Woodley, you know, we're not going to have the luxury of a polite exchange with FTA, and I've reviewed all those documents, and, well, we can't do it, how can we do it, and all of that. I mean, we're going to be obviously in a very different position. And we can respond certainly about the replacement of the rail cars, the 1000 series, but of course the 1996 accident was the 3000 series when it telescoped, and so on and so forth. So I think that as well intentioned as this process is, I mean, I think we may have waited until we see just what this NTSB thing is. I think a second point I would make is that it would be very helpful for me if we began to have more information. We've got some, I know, but on the $300 million, the capital money that we're going to have in FY10, because that's definitely a bird in the hand. I hope. I mean, we're guarding, feverishly guarding the $50 million in the district funding. It's not been easy, by the way. You didn't hear that, Neil. But it's not been easy, but we've still shepherded that $50 million. And we will know shortly, or we'll be receiving money shortly, I guess.
I'm hoping so.
Has the president signed it?
Actually, it's still in the conferee stage. Both the House and the Senate have passed the bill. It's just some language difference.
But anyway, so can we get a subpart of this prioritization process for the $300 million?
Yes.
I mean, it's being applied to the capital budget development for this coming year.
Right. But...
Wait, no, I understand what you're asking for.
When these two words, NTSB recommendations, come out, you know, we're going to have to review everything that we can. My final question is, you know, we're all involved in planning these stakeholder meetings, which, you know, I have kind of a nagging question in my mind about this, because I'm not, you know, we're planning the actual outline of the program, and I guess that's happening everywhere else also. But the amount of data that we're actually going to have to present, I mean, would we present this, for example? Would we, I mean, just in the sense of educating those people who are coming, and we are planning a public comment period, I guess everybody else is too. But, I mean, getting this into some kind of specific information level, I mean, how is all of this going to relate to that?
Well, this, not the entire report, no. But part of this will be part of my presentation.
But,
yes.
we need to, are we doing these stakeholder meetings too soon?
I don't believe so. I think.
And when is our schedule for it? The 19th of ours is the 19th of October in D.C. I mean, is it too soon to have a really meaningful discussion? Because if we don't have that, I think I have a very good idea of what this is likely to be.
I think it's timely because we are going to bring under board direction a budget to you in December, and we need that input. And moving forward to developing that budget.
Well, what is the input that, I mean, if I was showing up as just simply, a resident, you know, what would the input I would give you in us? What would I be likely to say?
I can't say what you would say.
I mean this metaphorically. What are people likely to say? They're going to come and they're going to say, make the system safer?
I think there's a whole host of issues on the table. It's the funding issue and funding constraints, options that we need to look at from a budgetary standpoint. I mean, there's no secret that the jurisdiction's revenues are coming in less than what they estimated just a few months ago. That impacts us, and we have a range of options that we need to look at, and this is explaining those range of options from a communication standpoint. At least putting them out there.
Right, and that's exactly what I'm trying to say. Perhaps not very well. But whatever we provide these participants at the beginning of the meeting, and we're going to, in D.C., we're going to do a panel, you know, although we haven't worked out all the panels yet. But whatever we provide people at the beginning of the meeting is going to be educational in terms of what they're likely to say. Right, whether we have an open question of whether we're even including the capital budget, but I don't know why we wouldn't. But anyway, so what is going into preparing, relating these materials that we're going to get in this presentation and the ones that follow into the stakeholder meeting?
I've seen it, I've looked at it, but
we are working with the staff from each of the jurisdictions right now on tailoring the messaging out to our customers, or out to the public for these public meetings.
At the meeting?
I'm sorry, at the meeting, right. So at this point, we've actually met with all the staff from each of the three jurisdictions and are kind of finalizing of what's going to be going into the presentation and make sure that we get the feedback that we need. So this is very helpful.
There is an outline presentation, again, that talks about our estimates of the costs, our estimates on revenues, expenses, capital program, various options, the operating issues that we're confronted with in the upcoming year, all of those are included. It's a pretty extensive presentation. It covers all of various
It's about 25 pages, and it kind of goes into the background of how we got to the point that we are, the economic drivers.
How long will it take?
We expect it to take 15 to 20 minutes. We expect to get to the panel discussion is going to be the most important part, panel and public discussion.
Could I suggest, Mr. Graham, that that's something we would all like to see and review and comment on?
Well, it's just this is about to happen. It's the point I'm making. I mean, I don't know, when is Maryland?
Ours isn't until November.
Well, maybe we should cut ours out.
So what I think staff does intend to make sure that the board has a chance to look at all of this and comment on it.
I don't know when. Ours is the 19th.
Maybe tomorrow.
No, that's
soon. Maybe
it's the 19th. No, he mentioned tomorrow.
The package. Mr. Zimmerman.
Yeah. I mean, my reaction to this is that this is a good time to start this conversation, and I view this as the beginning of a conversation with a broader set of stakeholders. It's definitely, we certainly don't have all the information you'd like ideally, but that's the point, is that we're starting the process by which we're going to get it, and this is an effort to bring more people into that process with us. And I think that, so part of my answer to the questions you posed is I definitely think this has to be part of that discussion, because people need to understand, you know, how this fits into everything, because this is the really big deal stuff. Most of the things that people are concerned about, get frustrated with, worry about, with Metro have to do with these long-term investments, and that's the problem. The main things that we've not done adequately are long-term, I mean, over the past 35 years. And so if we don't get people thinking ahead, you know, it's always easy. That's why, I mean, it's the reason capital gets deferred, right? I mean, it's future pain, present pain, and we need to get people to begin understanding that. This won't complete anything, and I think that this is going to be some ways more about the information that we provide than it is that we take in. When we get later in the process, in the budget, the hearing is more about listening to the public. But this is the beginning of a process for a larger public and other stakeholders, particularly people who are decision makers around the region, to kind of be brought into the difficult questions that we face both with this year's budget and with how we meet the capital challenge over the next decade. And I think it's important that we get that conversation started.
Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, Mr. Zimmerman made me think about some other issues that we may want to address at these meetings, and I'll leave it up to the staff and others to make that determination. But, you know, we're going to go through this big period of red line station rehabilitation in the next few years, as well as other line rehabilitation, which will result in certainly service impacts. And I guess really the question is this the time to start least outlining to them to look out for this? You know, this is coming up. It's going to happen. You know, here's the timeline, and just be aware that this is the result of this. As we're doing this, you're going to see, as Ms. Hudgens said, these kind of improvements. That's the kind of stuff we should be putting out there. So that's just my two cents on it.
Mr. Linton.
That wasn't my original thought, but I'll just add to your comment that, you know, and it goes back to the substance point again, that, you know, we tend to present this information for us, which is good in terms of the nature of the investment, the cost of the investment, projected savings and the like, but the customer on the street wants to know what impact does it have on my life.
That's right.
And what we do with the red line is not so much talking about what we're doing, but what does this do to my time savings? What does this do to capacity? How quickly am I going to get up and down the elevators? What kind of seating am I going to have on the rail cars in terms of capacity? What's the time between headways? So, I mean, I think we got to get it to the point where it's customer facing and the customer knows what, and people can get through inconvenience to some degree if you let them know at the end of this inconvenience, this is the improvement that it's going to have on your life. And we don't necessarily do a good job of conveying that. And I think we need to try to see what we can do better communicate. Yes, for 2 months, this elevator is going to be down, but your reliability is going to be X. So stay with us on that. And this is what the outcome is going to be for you. try to do a little bit better than that. And getting back to Mr. Graham's question, I think this is a good communication, as my good friend from Arlington suggested. It's the beginning of the process. It's probably no different than most jurisdictions and others are doing in their own budgets, as they're presenting information, gathering information, communicating to stakeholders on what their constraints and their outcomes are. But that's also a sliding scale, because, you know, things are going to change. This is, you know, what we're talking about this month will not be the same 4 months from now. Just like you, Mr. Graham, I know in your own budget with the district, you're kind of looking at your budget figures, preparing for the upcoming budget year. But you also know, based upon your sales tax and other things that occur, that could be impacted, and you have to present some differently. So our process is no different than that.
Any other comments?
Well, in terms of the NTSB, we focus quite appropriately on the rail car issue. But it's the technology issue that is the greater concern. Because, I mean, once again, we could be faced with an overwhelming, you know, recommendation. And when the NTSB made its recommendation on the rail cars in 2000, was it 2004? You know, it was... I mean, having read all of this in the past several months, I mean, it was just very casually presented, you know. They replaced all the 1,000 series. What's the problem here? Well, you know, and if I may finish, if they take the same approach with some of the technology issues, you know, we're obviously going to be in a position where we could easily be overwhelmed, financially and otherwise.
And the role of the NTSB is to provide a technological solution and a technological recommendation, and not to do a trade-off as to how any of those items might affect other factors, which may be equally as important. Mr. Linton.
I think this time, Mr. Graham, rather than a letter response to the NTSB, we need to get ahead of, if there's a recommendation that's imposed that's similar to that, we need to get a reality test for everybody in the region, the Congress, and everyone else, understanding what that actually means to where we are in terms of resources, what the trade-offs are, and where the money's going to come from. So I think rather than just responding back to them, because they will give us a wish list that's going to be unconstrained by reality, and all the attention in the region through every newspaper is going to be about, this is something that Metro needs to do. Unfortunately, we are constrained. We can't operate the way that they do. But to get ahead of that, we need to put that out front and get everybody engaged in that, rather than just dueling with them with letters, letting know, and then once again, 5 years later, they go back to the letters and what their recommendations are. We can't allow ourselves to get in that position.
Let me suggest that we have an item before us that was information only. It is important, I think, that what was defined was a process that involves all of us and our staffs on a regular basis, and that does provide the opportunity, as events like an NTSB finding come to us, to revise and adjust the numbers and the projects. And I think that definition of a process is an extremely valuable one. Since we have been talking about customer impact and ridership, I would like to at least comment on behalf of my fellow Red Line riders that we are all very pleased, Mr. Cato and Mr. Francis, that we now have our service back up to the level that we had experienced a year ago, and that we're now feeling much happier about the service we have. It's one of the more difficult things to expect our customers to hang in there with us, and to a very great degree, I think they did through some very difficult times. And it's very nice now to see those trains just go rolling by really quickly, and another one right behind this one, which does raise the question of what's happening with our ridership, which is the next
before
item.
Before you do that, last question.
Mr. Zimmerman, before we go on to ridership, and then we'll go back to the audit report.
And just to close this thing, there's another one I don't need an answer to, but I'd like you to be thinking about it, the way we talked about this. What I'd focused on earlier, Mr. Linton, some other comments, focus on kind of very particular things about how these decisions will impact service, which I think is really important. There's also a high-level need to understand kind of the magnitudes involved, put them in perspective, because $8 billion, $11 billion, everybody hears this, what does that mean? So, you know, there's particular ways of doing that particular project, but on a high level, when we, before we had Metro Matters and all that, the last time we were facing this question, one of the ways that we looked at it was in terms of how much replacement investment essentially was being made in Metro historically, and, you know, what it, in very rough, general, high-level terms should be. If you have a certain estimate of the value of your capital assets, and there's an overall, you know, rule of thumb for what depreciation is, that kind of tells you what you need to replace. And I seem to remember that there's, you know, sort of a general notion that about 3% is what you need. Presumably, if the average life of the asset's a little over 20 years, then, you know, 20 to 25 years, then that would get to somewhere around 3%. And that it looked like in the first 20 or 25 years, Metro was doing like 1. And we cranked it up some years ago, and we got it to something like 2. Again, these are very rough terms. But we were still not really where we should have been. And I would ask if you look at whether you can do something similar to that, so we can have some kind of, gives people some idea of how far off we are, just in rough, gross terms, for where you should be if you want to maintain a system like this. And that partly helps answer the question, we've put a whole lot into capital over the last decade. We did crank it up, but I don't think we can say it was ever cranked up to the level it really should be. And so there's a continuing issue. Anyway, that's my last question. Thank you.
Can we move on to the ridership and revenue?
Good morning. Actually, before I start, I'd like to just introduce a new member to our team, Matt Brown, who is replacing Rick Harcum. He's our new managing director for operating and capital. He comes at a very difficult time, and I know he's going to meet the challenges that we all face here, so I just wanted to introduce Matt. FY10 ridership and revenue. In this presentation, I'm going to present the latest forecast of revenue, and it's really based on the first 2 months of actuals that we have received for this fiscal year, July and August. Although the committee has previously received our financial monthly performance report that we provide, we have not had an ability to discuss this, the implications of what we see our actuals for developing a forecast. And to some extent, developing a forecast with just 2 months of data would seem very, very preliminary. But I believe given the circumstances, the economy, the accident on the red line, and some of the challenging budget that we have for this year, I think it's prudent to get ahead of the game on this. And that's really what we wanted to talk about with you today. So the purpose here is to talk about some of the trends that we see in the bus and rail ridership for the 2 months, some of the factors which impact ridership, which are not new to transit, and most other transits across the nation are experiencing some similar things. Our unemployment clearly affecting bus and rail ridership, and the impact of the red line, which is specific to us. Given that service levels have not been at the peak amount, we've seen a decline in some of the passenger trips in each direction. As Mr. Benjamin had indicated, we've communicated that we are at capacity on our red line, so obviously we're looking at trying to improve that. We believe the ridership will improve on that line over the next several months. Gas prices are at lower levels than they were in the prior year. People are making some decisions with regard to that. How much every one of these variables impacts our ridership, we cannot be sure. But coming together, we can actually see a little bit of a picture forming. On the next chart, let's look at the month performance. I actually want to focus you on the chart that's down below, which is really the year-to-date ridership for July and August. If we look at just rail, we see that our actuals are falling below budget. Just to give you, there's the dollar amount there. I'm sorry, ridership amount there. Thank you. From a percentage point, that's about 6% below budget ridership levels. And from the prior year, ridership's levels are down about 3%. Our budget assumed an increase in ridership for rail growth at 3%, if you recall. So we are currently, just in these 2 months, not meeting our ridership growth as budgeted. Cross has been impacted slightly more, with the ridership actuals falling below budget by about that number there. That's about 8%. And they're down from the prior year about 5%. The growth level for bus in the budget was not as much as rail, in the range of 1%. And Metro Access is growing slightly above budget. Just for the last 2 months, we're seeing a slight increase over budget on Metro Access.
Okay, we have some questions. Mr.
Sure.
Giancole.
The red line accident, you're saying, is still negatively affecting rail ridership. Are the other lines maintaining the numbers we projected?
We have seen a slight decrease on the other lines. When we look at the other lines, we look at all the other routes.
What kind of
not as much as
what
the
kind of percentage you're talking about?
We're seeing 2% on some lines. We're seeing 4.5% on other lines.
That's significant.
Not as much as the red line. The red line decrease we were seeing was about 8%. So in those 2 months, we were seeing some other decreases in some of the other lines. We can't contribute. I guess my in answer to your question, I'm not sure about attributing that just to the accident, or can we attribute those declines due to the economy? And that's really what I can't.
I'm more concerned that we're providing a total picture here of the whole system, not just the other line.
Okay. Well, I think some of your numbers would suggest that the accident in and of itself may be a contributor. If you look at the difference between the red line and your other lines, but the numbers also suggest that we're having a reduction overall, particularly when you look at the bus as well. I mean, it's easy for people to just say, okay, you know, you had an accident on the rail, so everybody's making other choices and other decisions. But we didn't have any accidents on the buses to the degree that would stop people providing buses. So there's a trend here that maybe reflected the economy, people not being out as much, not going to job, the reduction in jobs, and all that may have an impact on our numbers here. That may be a more active trend.
If in fact we can go about two or three more slides, I think we'll see exactly that effect and how the red line relates to employment levels. Mr. Cater, did you want to say something?
I was just going to say I was at a meeting of the American Public Transportation Association, and ridership across the country has fallen. And several factors, they looked into it also. There was huge increases last year, the highest in over 50 years of ridership, and fuel had a lot to do with it. When you have a combination, fuel prices dropping, significant national unemployment, the numbers drop, and you look historically. The issues this year has been, while there's been a decline, not the same degree of decline you would have anticipated with the high 10% unemployment, but you would expect a large decrease in ridership. And that's been historical every recession. There's high unemployment, transit ridership declines.
Why don't we try and get those next couple slides out there and then continue this discussion right there.
So on the revenue picture, what is that ridership? How does that translate into what it does to our revenue for Metro? The impact, as you can see here, is that for the 2 months, we saw a decline in revenue of about 6%. That's the and we saw a bus decline in revenue of about 12%. Those are the numbers up there, 5.8 and then the 2.3. Metro Access, again, is slightly an increase to budget due to the ridership demands. Overall revenues, we're predicting right now, are down by 8.2, which is a 7% change. However, when we look at the two-month trend, this is important. We can look at this. For the month of July, we have seen a 9% reduction in revenue. More in rail, maybe as a result of the accident, about 10%, and we saw in bus with about 7%. When we looked at the month of August, our revenues were down only 4%. So what we may be experiencing is the erosion in July, not as much in August. And I don't have my September numbers in yet, but I believe some of the preliminary numbers are showing that we're starting to level off a bit. It says that maybe we don't have as much of a decline going forward in the rest of the first half of this year. but is still a decline from the budget that we've actually approved. So that's what we see now for revenue for the first 2 months. If you look at the next page, we get to the comment, we get to the information that we were just talking about in terms of our unemployment. In the region, we're very affected. Our unemployment, the nation's unemployment, affects ridership, obviously, very much so. In the D.C. region, the unemployment is about 11%. We have some comparable numbers for Maryland and Virginia. For Virginia, northern Virginia area, could be about 6.5%. I think that's the number that we've looked at. Maryland statewide is a little bit above 7%. All that said, I think that the region is the transit ridership is suffering from some of those economic declines. And you can see on the chart that we have here, the red line shows the unemployment rate. And as you can see, the subsequent lines down there show peak. They show average weekday, and you can see the declining trend on ridership there.
Let's go back to those.
The last blue line that you see here, I don't have a little highlight chart, but it shows July numbers were down, a slight bit of an uptick in August, which shows how my revenue loss is not happening as bad. And we hope to see a September number that actually levels that out. On the next page, we look at the bus ridership. It's the same type of a trend that we're showing. In bus ridership, it's more affected because we have a lot of our service industries that are more affected with the unemployment, and as a result, that translates into ridership declines more in bus than it does in rail. The blue line that you see that looks a little funny up and down is only because we do a year-to-year analysis. And in some months, in prior years, we may have more days of the week, if you will, than we do in this year. In this year, more months of the days that we calculate bus ridership. But if you look at the trend, it's going down. If you go to the next.
Before we go any farther, there were a bunch of questions. And let me start with one question, which is, if you took out red line and looked at the other lines, would you say that the rate of decrease in ridership on rail looks approximately like the rate of increase in unemployment in D.C.? Do those correlate reasonably well? Not including the red line.
If we normalized for the red line, yep. And I looked at the rail.
Looked at all the other lines and said, are they decreasing at about the same rate that unemployment is increasing in downtown D.C.? Because we have a radial system.
There seems to be a strong correlation to that, but
okay, so that's
before the accident.
That's something that we can expect to continue, that effect. So to the degree that we reflect to a large amount of peak traffic associated with employment, if there's less employment, we're going to have less traffic, and therefore we're going to have that decline in our ridership because the people don't need the ride. On the other hand, the red line portion, which is related to the accident, is likely to return, and so we have an exaggerated July and August that's going to be mitigated a little bit as we move to September and October, providing that Mr. Francis doesn't do too much maintenance there that causes people to not ride anymore. But assuming that we can maintain that service, we have only the unemployment effect. And in bus, is it reflecting D.C. employment, or what is it really reflecting?
In the bus, it's reflecting, we looked at the top routes, and someone from bus, Jim Hamry, can talk about the ridership levels here, but just to answer your question, we've looked at it. It looks like it's affecting more of the D.C. and the Maryland buses, the high ridership buses. That's where we're losing the most ridership.
And is that occurring approximately at the same rate as we're losing jobs throughout the region?
There's a direct correlation to that, yes.
Direct correlation. So what we're seeing is, to the degree that we continue to lose jobs within the region, we can expect people not to ride the system in order to get to the jobs they don't have.
Yes, that's correct.
And that as the unemployment rate levels off and starts to turn around, we would expect our ridership to follow in the same way.
Yes, and actually, it leads into the next chart. This
well, let me make sure that other people get their chance to comment, yep, also. Yep. But basically, what we're saying is we're seeing the effect that Mr. Cato talked about that is a national effect. And basically, it's the kind of thing that there's very little control we can have over employment rates and therefore the number of people who are using our system to get to their jobs.
Okay. Yeah, just to clarify, if you go to the previous chart, one more, I guess. All right, you talked in your verbal comments about the fact that the metropolitan unemployment is a certain level. On these charts, it says D.C. unemployment. Are
yes.
you just talking about the District of Columbia here?
No.
Are you talking about the metro area?
We're talking about the metro area.
But you should probably relabel that then.
That's
not
correct.
Not just say District of Columbia, which that implies. So.
You're right.
Okay.
And we actually.
That was the only point I wanted to make.
Any other comments? Mr. Brandt.
I mean, are you tagging all of this to unemployment issues? I mean, are there other factors?
No.
That are significant, that need to be understood?
A significant factor is unemployment. It's at an all-time high.
I got that.
I think the other factors that we are looking at is the gas prices, who are now lower than they were last year. So people are making now different choices. And those are the two primary factors. The other factor is the accident. And I think that what's happening is in our view, in the 2 months that we've had, we are looking at, with the capacity now that we have on the red line, our estimate is that we are going to power through that impact so that what we will have left is really this, the two factors on gas prices and the economic unemployment conditions.
Right, but the bus rather than the rail, which is the next chart.
Was there a question there, Mr. Graham?
Well, no. I mean, do you think the gas prices are affecting this?
Sure.
Definitely. It's just the way in which you've structured these two graphs, which, and I know you've taken something that is relatively objective and comparing it to something else which is objective, but I'm maybe just a little bit misleading.
Mr. Zimmerman. Well,
you said the accident. But you haven't said how the accidents affected, and I was surprised not to see that in this presentation, Mr. Cato. I mean, how has the accident affected the ridership? In what way has it affected it? Why has it affected it?
You said the drop was less in August than July, correct?
The drop in ridership for the red line?
Yes.
Was more in July and then less in August.
Yeah, right.
That's correct.
Relative to previous time.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's correct.
This is actually not a hard question, but it's perhaps not a financial question, but people who run the system probably can give the answer. Why is there any effect of the accident on June 22nd on ridership after June 22nd?
An impact of the accident because of the way we were operating services, not being system slowed up, we had fewer vehicles.
The capacity of Metro Rail has been reduced from June 23rd to yesterday. Is that right?
Yes.
And it was impacted and reduced by more at some times in that period than at others.
That is true.
From things like whether or not you were single tracking, whether you were running absolute block, how many trains you were running through there.
Yes.
Could you put some numbers to that?
Yes, we can. Yes, we will.
Well, as we have communicated, we will communicate that the red line ridership in July was down by 10% and in August was down by 8% compared to the prior years in 2008.
I'm sorry, Ms. Kissel. I'm not asking about the ridership, who actually showed up and rode. I'm asking about our capacity to accommodate riders.
Okay.
Perhaps Mr. Francis can answer that question for us.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. I know you've asked that question before. If I can just read this, maybe this will kind of clarify some things. Before the accident, we had the capacity to move a total of 36,000 passengers.
On the red line?
On the red line. During the peak rush hour. Post-accident, from June 23rd to September 28th, we had the capacity to move a total of 24,000 per passenger during the peak rush hour on the red line.
So in other words, that's a reduction of a third of the capacity on that
line.
And the trains were largely full before we started. Is that right?
Before we started.
So that would argue that a third of the people couldn't find a place to ride.
But there were packed conditions, there's no question about it, which impacted, but the capacity, when you drop it by a third, has a significant impact on people's willingness to utilize the service, and in some cases, their abilities to use it.
Yeah. And also keeping in mind that some of the ridership also went to the bus system as well.
So there should have been a surge there.
And there was,
yes, and there was.
But there was a surge, but we still lost bus passengers, even
yes.
with the surge.
Correct.
System-wide, yeah.
Correct.
But this is the point that, you know, I was surprised not to see this. Our most heavily used rail line has been down capacity as much as a third for the last 3 months. There's, no matter what else was happening, we were going to lose ridership. You know, I mean, there's no way around that. The overall impact on the system, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Francis, is about 10-11%. You take that impact on the right, you know, and we're doing it in terms of red line itself.
Yes.
But it's like a tenth of our capacity went away the last 3 months. We only got it back this week. So, you know, yes, we have the economy affecting us, but even if we didn't, we'd have had an impact on the ability to carry people on the rail system because we have had less rail system for the last 3 months.
Yes.
I think there's another point that goes with that. The statistics that you've been telling us seem to show that the reduction in the red line relates to the capacity and the ability to carry the people. And, yeah, there's an overlay of loss of jobs, but that's nowhere near as great an effect as the fact that people just couldn't get on the trains and the quality of service was down until yesterday. On all the other lines, the reduction appears to be related to the economy. And what that tells us is that our ridership believes our system is safe and they stay with us to the degree that they have a destination to go to. And that the reductions that we are seeing don't relate to fear associated with the accident, but just the ability to use the system and whether or not they have a destination to go to, a job that they want to ride to. So our ridership reduction is almost entirely either economic or capacity constrained, and does not relate to people's reaction to the accident, as close as we can tell. Is that a reasonable statement?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Mr. Benjamin, one other thing, too. The unemployment was mentioned, and although these may be regional levels, the fact of the matter is the unemployment in the district has really spiked. And our system is concentrated in the district. I mean, that's the destinations and all that. So, you know, that means you should see an impact. You know, and the bus system is heavily in the district. And again, they're suffering the higher level of employment.
The employees who are most impacted are coming from the suburbs.
Not necessarily those on the bus system, however.
No, I think on the bus system.
Well, the one thing on the bus system I would say that was interesting is that the S9, which was just launched just before the problem occurred, right, reached its 24-month ridership goal in the first 3 months, and the 79 also experienced great ridership. So I think that reflects what Mr. Van was referring to earlier, that we were being down in the red line corridor, we got a lot more ridership on those bus corridors, even though there was an overall decline in the system.
Mr. Giancalvin.
Yeah, it also just generally, if you look at the numbers, it looks like clearly we're going to see a reduction in revenues and significant reduction in revenues. Are there any actions you're anticipating right now, Mr. Cato? Hiring freezes, et cetera, to counterbalance this starting right now?
I think you're getting towards the end of
okay.
this presentation.
Yes.
Are there any other comments at this point, or shall we
secure the presentation?
Okay, why don't you go ahead with it? Mr. Linton.
The significant measurement is going to be what are the numbers we're going to be seeing in the next couple of months on the red line in terms of now that we're back to capacity, we're back to service levels. It'll be interesting to see what the recovery levels are.
So let's finish this presentation, which feels to some degree or doesn't feel to some degree.
Okay, so the last part of this chart just talks about what does this do to revenue. And what we're looking at, actually, if you get down to the bottom, is a $22 million decline in revenue for the balance of the year. We based this forecast on the fact that what we've seen for these 2 months, the decline, we based this forecast that we will see some type of leveling off in the first half of this year by December, and that from December to June, the balance of the second half, that the economy will level out and our transit ridership will not erode any further and may even get a little bit better. So this is not the worst-case scenario, but it, right now it actually is, based upon those assumptions, what we see in terms of revenue decline.
Was this a straight-line projection of what we were seeing in July and August projected through December, or did you actually curve it down some? Mr. Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Benjamin. The forecast assumes that we will experience similar declines that we saw in the first 2 months of the fiscal year through December, and then we will fight
after that.
Yes.
And does it in any way assume that now that we have capacity back on the red line that we might have a different effect on the red line, or is it just the overall effect that you saw in the first 2 months projected out?
It's the overall effect.
Okay. So we, to that degree, we haven't accommodated the increased service on the red line, but we also haven't said that there's going to be a potential problem beyond December.
That's correct, and it's something that we'll obviously look into in the future.
Okay, Mr. Lynn.
We have our revenue forecast, but if a third of our system is down the red line, what's the operating reductions? Don't we have some operating savings when we're not operating the same system?
Yes, I'm sorry.
And what's the offsets with that?
And that is the next steps, actually, which we will look at. We're currently analyzing our scheduling, the impacts to the lines, and tying that to resource and understanding what the impact of that reduction is going to be. And we're coming back to the board in November to actually describe what our mitigation plan is for that.
That's on your last page?
On the last page.
So what you're telling us is there are some ways to have additional savings, and you want to look at those and come back and propose to us what you might do, which is getting at Mr. Giancola's question. Mr. Cato, did you want to say something?
Actually, that's what I wanted to respond to. We have already begun the process of various options. We're not going to wait. We do not have time to wait. This is an issue we have to deal with very quickly, and assuming there is not assuming there is a drop in revenues, and we're going to have to make reductions in our expenditures to match those. And we're working on that. Some of those we're just going to take an action. Others actions might require some. We will notify the board of what the specific actions are, but we should have something over the next few weeks. Again, some of them are immediate actions we're taking. Some of them are longer range actions. But it, we must come up with a plan to reduce our expenses to match the revenue reduction.
If there are no other comments, I'd like crisis. Did you have a comment?
I just said a new crisis.
A new crisis. I'm not sure it's a crisis. It's within the range of being able to control the costs. If we could, why don't we go back to our one action item on the audit, accepting the audit. Ms. Liu?
You don't want to finish the financial report?
Sorry?
We don't need to do the financial report.
We need to get this report and act on this report.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Helen Liu. I'm the Vermont Inspector General. Sitting next to me is Michael Stevens. He is the partner at Clifton Gunderson, who is our external auditor. We are here today to request acceptance of the fiscal year 2009 external audit deliverables submitted by Clifton Gunderson. External auditors audited Metro's financial statements in accordance to government auditing standards. For fiscal year 2009. Mike will brief the members of the committee on the results of this audit.
Good afternoon. I do have a slide presentation to go through. I'm happy to answer any questions if they arise in the process. We just our audit approach, we did include a subcontractor, Temple Lobbying Associates. It's a multi-tiered approach. The audit team includes auditors, IT specialists, pension specialists because of the new requirements of accounting standards, and compliance specialists related to single audit requirements for federal funding. Recall last year we were required to implement new risk assessments. This year is just an update of those requirements related to that. throughout the audit process, we're communicating with management. Management that we worked with in the current year was processed, but I think it was very effective. First and foremost, I want to get to the audit results. First and foremost, the audit opinion on the financial statements is unqualified, which is the best that you can have. It's basically a clean opinion. It says that the financial statements are in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. With respect to the, as Ms. Lee referred to, we'd also audited in accordance with government auditing standards, and as such, we're required to look at your internal controls and compliance issues. We did have some comments in those areas, one deemed to be a material weakness and nine significant deficiencies. The next slide addresses what those issues were. First and foremost was the capitalization of construction costs resulting in a prior period adjustment. I do want to clarify that this was not, the costs were not captured. It was more of an issue of how they were recorded on the financial statements of the authority. And I should say management has subsequently corrected that issue. The next comments relate to capital asset reporting. That's more related to limitations of the system in which those assets are recorded, to some documentation issues with respect to payroll, the timing of cash deposits that come into remote locations, and then there was various IT controls, most of those relating to access controls, passwords, and assignment of users and user access upon termination. As far as audit adjustments resulting from the audit, the most significant items were related to the construction progress that I just referred to. The prior period adjustment for the capital assets included in construction progress, and the related adjustment to depreciation as a result of the change in construction in progress. There was also an unrecorded audit adjustment that we were obligated to report to you, an item that was deemed immaterial. There was a variation between the actuary and the attorney and their assessment of the accrual required for the June 22nd accident. In addition to the audit, we are also required to perform certain agreed-upon procedures. Those procedures are in process. I do not have reports completed for you today on those. They are all done as part of a subsequent process to the actual issuance of the financial statements, which will occur subsequent to this meeting. With respect to the single audit, and the single audit is how we report to users of the financial statements compliance with requirements of receiving federal funds, and we issue two reports on the single audit. One is a report on your compliance with government auditing standards, and the second one is on compliance with requirements of the specific grants that you receive through those federal funds. The major program we audited in accordance with that single audit was the Department of Transportation Federal Transit Cluster. As I mentioned previously, we did have one finding in the single audit on the compliance side, and that finding related to the use of the indirect cost rate. Basically, what occurred was that there was a delay in the approval of that rate by the FTA, and the authority continued to use that rate even though it was not approved. So it's a timing issue. And management does concur with that comment that we identified. We do also issue a separate management letter. These are comments that do not rise to the level of materiality for purposes of financial reporting. There was one item included in that letter, and that related to inventory value, parts inventory, and so on. There are some limitations with respect to the system, and there's also an issue with respect to as inventory is removed or moved forward into use, when is that inventory relieved? We just have a control matter related to that issue as far as valuing that inventory that's shifted. The last thing we do as part of the audit process is report to the committee. Basically, the premise of this required communication is that we perform an audit on your behalf in your role as on the committee, but we're not working with the board members on a day-to-day basis, and as such, we're obligated to report to you how the audit went, in effect. Admittedly, in very boilerplate language, we're required to communicate certain things with respect to the audit. The first bullet here is that
that we simply that we audited the finance statements in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards for the period ended June 30th, 2009. So we did not discuss any significant issues with management prior to retention. This issue addresses the issue of opinion shopping, and we're giving assurances that that did not occur in this case. Next items are consultations with other accountants. Basically, this would arise if we had a disagreement with management. We, as the auditors, had a disagreement with management with respect to the accounting treatment of any type of transaction. We would now be obligated to report that to you if we did not have anything in those matters. Qualitative aspects of accounting practices. Basically, we're complying with generally accepted accounting principles and governmental accounting standards. There was one new standard this year that did impact the financial statements of the authority. That relates to pollution remediation, and there was a small accrual related to a matter that came to our attention during the audit. The next slides discuss the preparation of financial statements. We just need to communicate to the board that there are estimates in the preparation of the financial statements. In the case of the authority, we do make certain estimates with respect to deferred revenues, pension benefit assumptions. We rely on an outside actuary to make determinations with respect to retirement age and life expectancy and so on. Benefits other than pensions, that mostly relates to health care costs, and obviously there are certain assumptions made with respect to escalation of health care costs, amounts of contributions of employees and so on. And then lastly, probably most importantly, is the liability for injury and damage claims. With the accident this year, we relied heavily and actually worked with the actuary directly in determining their basis for calculating the related accrued liability in that area. And we deemed in all cases that there was a reasonable basis and that management went about the determination process to accrue those amounts properly. Since the financial statement disclosures, the most important items from our end were the tax lease disclosures and the injury and damage claims related to the accident this year. Difficulties encountered in performing the audit. The biggest issues we had this year were the construction progress issue, which I alluded to earlier, and the contingent liabilities related to the accident. They probably had the most significant impact on the financial statements in the current year. And required additional audit steps to satisfy us with respect to how they were being reported. Corrected misstatements I've referred to earlier is the construction and progress adjustment and related depreciation. And then the last step of the audit is the signing of the representation letter. Basically, what this letter requires or is required by professional standards. What it requires is that management represents to us certain information that they provided to us during the course of the audit. When the board receives the final product, the report's actually issued, a copy of that representation letter that they signed will be attached to that letter so that the board members can see exactly what management is representing as a part of the process. We're also required to document any disagreements with management. We did not have any this year. There were some difficult issues, but management was open and we communicated freely with respect to those issues. And to come to a resolution, and there were any significant matters I've already reported, so there wasn't anything outside the scope of that reporting that we felt necessary to report to the board. So I know I've moved through that very quickly, just as far as the detail of the financial information, so on, but I'm happy to answer any questions that anyone would have.
Mr. Stevens, let me try and summarize what I think I heard you say.
Okay.
We received an unqualified opinion which says that our books are in good shape, and that's the highest level that we can get in terms of the quality of the way we're keeping our records. Is that right?
That's correct.
You did have a series of findings, but almost all of those really affected the way we categorize our assets and our liabilities, which does not have a direct effect on either the operating or the capital budget or the subsidies that are given by the jurisdictions. Is that also right?
That's true. Keep in mind that our financial statements are generally accepted accounting-based as opposed to budgetary-based, so you're correct.
Right. So those are important adjustments that need to be made in the books, but they don't have an immediate effect on how we actually operate or what it is that the jurisdictions are required to pay for the services provided by the authority or the capital program that they're carrying out.
That's true.
Okay. With that statement, I'd entertain a motion for us to approve the resolution, which is on the very last page of the package, which does accept the report by the auditors.
I would so move.
And is there a second?
Second.
Second by Ms. Hutchins. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No? None. Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate that report. Very smooth, nicely done. I think it's important at this point that we look at least at the June financials, because that's the end of the year and we didn't have a chance to do that before.
And is it one item or is it three?
Yes. Let's do it as one item, all three financials. But I think the most important one is what happened at the end of the year in terms of where you ended up compared to where you originally projected.
And that's fine. I'll be brief. Since actually we talked about July and August to some extent as it relates to revenue and ridership in the prior presentation. So if we looked at June, the month of June performance shows a subsidy savings of $5.5 million at the end of the year. As you recall, we had projected, as we went through last year's budget, we had projected that we would actually be coming in at $9 million. We were short of that. We actually made great strides and improvements on managing our overtime and implementing some of the reductions that we had last year. So those were very successful. The item that actually eroded the $9 million forecast was primarily focused on two areas. One that I would call more of an uncontrollable expense, which was related to increased pension losses on our pension liability. So when our actuary came in by May, we actually had more information on the pension losses. That attributed to a couple million dollar erosion on that, as well as the fact that we actually had significant parts and inventory increases in June that we had not anticipated. So that eroded that $5.5 million. We actually looked at July to see if maybe there was a reversal in accrual. I know, Mr. Benjamin, you had made that point to us in prior pre-briefing committees, and we did notice that in July and August there was no credit adjustment relative to those parts. So we are still looking at that inventory, and I know Inspector General is actually doing an audit on our bench inventory to understand our processes on that. So that was June.
If I may comment very quickly on June, if we turn to page 69 and look at the column just to the left of the titles, the stuff that's the variance for the last month, and you look at the bottom part, you can see that there are three items that essentially combine more than changed the numbers from what was projected to where it is. One was fringe benefits. That was the contribution to pension plans, and that's $7.3 million beyond budget in 1 month alone. The next one was services, $4.6 million. That looks suspiciously like accruals, really, to save money for the next fiscal year, and it's something we really need to look at. A very, very large and sudden increase in the services. And finally, supplies, and that's partially what could be going to bench stock and could partially, which is not a legitimate charge, and partially the other cause would be the accident, where a lot of supplies are being used right there. You would expect that then to continue into July and August, and to some degree that did happen with supplies. The services number did what you would expect, it dropped immediately in July and August. So we do have something we probably ought to be looking at on services to see if perhaps accruals occurred there that may not have been justified.
Yes, we are looking at that. Again, we haven't seen it in July and August, but maybe those accruals are coming later, but we are looking at it.
I think the big issue is that with board approval, you can do accruals in the end of the fiscal year to pay for a one-time only contract in the following fiscal year.
Right.
But we had no requests on that. Do you want to say anything more? Anybody want to go in any more detail in July and August? You might want to just summarize where we are in August so far relative to subsidies.
Well, the August relative to the year-to-date, we're at the $10.8 million over budget on our subsidy position. you can see the bottom line. It's primarily due to the decline in revenue, which is 8.4. I'm sorry, I apologize. Page 124. And as you can see, if we look at the right-hand column, sorry, it's page 129. I apologize. It should say operating financials, August. If you look at the right-hand side, it's year-to-date results. The passenger revenue is down by $8.7 million year-to-date. And our expenses are down, or increased over budget by $3.1 million. And that puts us in a position of a $10.8 million subsidy over budget.
The largest variances there are in salaries, wages, and overtime, and in supplies. And would you say that those are related to the accident?
Most of that, a majority of that actually, if not all of it, is related to the overtime expenditures that we have incurred as a result of the work that we're doing that related to the accident.
Any of that, could any of that be capitalized?
And supplies as well. And some of the supplies, yes, can be capitalized. I will say on the overtime expenditures, currently it's not a capitalized expense, but we actually have forensics accountants that are in house currently that are looking at the overtime costs and all the costs associated with the accident and ensuring that we can recover those costs under our existing property and liability insurance program. So that process is happening.
So you're saying some of this overrun we might see disappear later on in the fiscal year when we adjust for that. Mr. Giancola.
Yeah, I thank you for the reports. I did notice the ARRA number as well. Gotten or received most of the money for that, it looks like, except for $2 million. I'd like to maybe suggest that we have at least a summary report for information purposes of how that how we're executing that program. Maybe at the next meeting.
Yeah. Stimulus.
I believe that's also on the web, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It
yeah,
is
it's on the web, but I'd like to
bring it to the board.
Could we have that report?
Yes, and actually we're modifying the reports going forward, and next month we will have a stimulus item in, briefing in this package.
Thank you.
Any other comments on the financials? I believe that completes our agenda, unless I missed something here.
One question. I was looking at the parking transaction and the average monthly parking fees and trying to get a sense of when you talk about passenger reduction, I was looking to see whether parking is not working as well.
That's a good question. We're looking at it as well. And actually, in July, our parking utilization was overall for all parking was 88.5% down from prior periods. But in August, and in August it went down even further to 85. Excuse me. July was 88.5, and August was 85.5. And we're looking at the utilization issues on our parking.
As someone who parks at our parking, I've noticed in recent months that it's been easy for me to find parking spaces.
And that's
at one point when I could not find one at all. Now I'm coming in various hours throughout the day and I'm finding available spaces.
We have shown a slight erosion in our parking passes that we issue from over the last 2 months, so that reflects that, and it correlates directly to the decline in the ridership that we're seeing.
Any other comments or questions?
Well, let's, since we're on, just catching up.
Mr. Graham.
Metro Access is showing what in the last 3 months?
Metro Access. Metro Access actually was showing on the prior charts. We don't have it specifically here, but was showing that they were a little bit over budget by about $100,000 in the 2 months for July and August, year to date. So
it's basically within budget.
Basically within budget. For now.
For now.
Thanks.
Mr. Albert.
Unrelated to the financial reports, where are we in the ordering? This is probably for Mr. Cato, in the ordering of the 203 buses we were promised in June.
Actually, Mr. Branch's notes exactly that you just said.
Right now, we have 131 on the property. 100 buses are in service. 31 that we're prepping and getting ready for. We look to have the last bus, I believe, as I look.
End of November.
The ones that arrive on the street now. There's the end, starting this week.
Okay, if that's the questions, we have one more action, and that is I move that members of the Finance Administration and Oversight Committee meet in executive session to discuss contractual matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral 6D and legal matters consistent with Board Procedure Roman numeral 6B. Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anybody opposed? Then we will move to executive session, at the end of which, since there are no items that appear to be action items in any way, this meeting will be adjourned.